this God-inspired message from Shofar Christian Church. We trust that you will enjoy today's message and that it will encourage you to grow deeper in your relationship with Christ our Savior.
I've entitled my sermon An Inconvenient Call. You know, so often we experience God's call as inconvenient, untimely, because we feel, I'm not ready, I'm not prepared, I'm not the right person. Can't God see that? Doesn't He know? Why does He call me? Why does He ask me to do that? You know, I'm not ready for this. I mean, throughout human history, that's been the case. Whether it's Moses, and we're going to read a little bit about Moses, whether it's Gideon. Remember what Gideon did when God called him? He said, my tribe is the least of the tribes of Israel. My father's house is the least of in the tribe, and I'm the least in my father's house. Why on earth are you calling me? Why do you want to use me? And so many others after that have responded in pretty much the same way. And the reality is, here's the reality. When we realize how big God's call is on our lives and how big the job is to do, we never feel ready. We never feel prepared. We never feel good enough. We never feel like we have the right resources. But ultimately, like God said to Moses, I am with you. And that's ultimately all that matters. Yes, you're not ready. You're not prepared. I mean, Moses had not even circumcised his own son. That's how unprepared he was to lead the people of God out of Egypt. Yes, he didn't have the right resources. Yes, maybe it wasn't the right season in his life. Now he just recently got married to Zipporah and they had a young child. And I can relate to that. You know, so often, you know, we try and postpone the calling of God on our lives because we feel it's not the right season. I'm not ready yet. I'm not at the right place in my life yet. You know, and I have two children, Kirsten, who's 7 years old, and Justin, who's 4 years old. And I remember sort of when your first child comes, it's really overwhelming. I mean, those of you who have children will know. Those of you whose children are older might have forgotten. And those who still don't have children, you'll find out. You know, it really is overwhelming. I mean, you have this little life that comes into your world and they're totally dependent on you. And you stand there and hold this little miracle in your arms and you think, what on earth am I going to do with this person? They're going to become, who they're going to become is going to depend to such a large extent on me that it scares me. And then, often, they don't sleep in the beginning. Or they get confused between day and night. They sleep during the day when you have to be awake, and then at night, you know, they want to be awake, and they keep you awake. And you have to try and get by without much sleep. And you're always worrying, you know, am I doing it right? Because they don't come with a manual. It's not like, you know, a product you buy where the instructions are like in the box. No instructions. I mean, obviously the Bible, you know, gives, you know, good wisdom and so on. But I mean, the practical stuff of, you know, how do you know when your child, you know, is feeling a bit sick or so? And obviously it helps to have people around you. But there are so many things you worry about. And it's so easy to fall into that trap of, God, just not now. Don't ask me to do anything now. Now's not the time. I'm not ready for it. And I remember someone challenging us while Rochelle and I were still in French Hook, pastoring the church there. And Kirsten was just born, it was while Rochelle was still pregnant with Kirsten, saying it wasn't really a challenge. It was more like just a testimony. And the person saying, you know, they've seen so many people. And I'm sharing this example. I mean, there are many other examples too, but this is the season I'm going through, so it's the one I can relate to. But they were saying that they see so many people, the children come, and then everything, your whole life just focuses on the kids, and you throw out your whole rhythm, your calling, your ministry, your everything, your involvement, you know, in your family, in your wider family, with your friends, in church, everything, so that you can just focus on this little baby. And she said, you know, often it goes on for a year or two, and then sort of you wake up, and she said, what changed her mind about that and sort of made her not go that route. But from the beginning, go on with her life and just have a kid slot into her life. And she said when she did that, you know, after a few years, she just realized how flexible kids are and how easily they can actually adapt to your life. She said, so they just went, kept on going to small group. And, you know, the kid would sleep in the little holder under the table or whatever. And later on, when they were bigger, 3, 4 years old, they'll just, you know, they put the kids, all the kids were there and they put them to bed together and they'll just go on and fellowship, and so on. Came to church. And she said, what made her realize that she needs to do that was not only that she needed that, but she realized her kids needed that. She realized her kids needed to see her fulfilling God's calling on her life in order to be prepared to fulfill their calling on their lives. But so often we think that we do our kids a favor by delaying our calling. And that's just one example. There are other reasons why we try and delay our calling as well. Lord, I just started a new job. Lord, that new job is your calling. That's the place where you're supposed to live out your calling. And every day you go to that new job, you're fulfilling your calling. You're either doing it effectively or you're not. I mean, why else are you going unless God has called you to be there? Right? So often we have all kinds of excuses. Lord, I'm just not ready. Lord, I'm not as spiritual as Stefan. I don't hear from the Lord like he does. Or I'm not as disciplined as whoever. I'm just not ready. And we have all kinds of excuses. But the reality is, if you think about it, you'll never be at the most convenient place in your life. And God's calling is always disruptive and inconvenient. And we must make peace with that. And we must embrace that. We need that. That's part of our discipleship. We'll never have all the resources. Oh, one day when I'm a millionaire, then I'm going to like, because I need resources for this calling that God has called me to do. You know, then I'll start doing it. No, God wants to start now in faith, even before you have everything that you need. Because then He can provide it. Now, if you only start when you already have everything you need, then you get the glory. Then you look good. But if you start and you have nothing, and God has to provide along the way, and you just have to trust Him to provide, then God gets glorified. And you'll never be ready and able enough. I mean, if we think that we can fulfill God's calling on our life, we've got what it takes to fulfill God's calling on our life. If you think you're hearing God saying, I want you to do this, and you say, yes, I've got it waxed, then you're probably not hearing from God. Then I'm probably not hearing from God. Because God will never call us to do something that we are able to do in our own strength. He'll always call us to do something that we need Him to do in us and through us. He'll always call us to do something that's bigger than we are able to handle, so that we need His grace, His Spirit to empower us. So we'll never get to a place where God calls us and if it's a genuine call from God, you'll never feel ready for it. You'll never feel competent to do it. And if we delay our calling because of those excuses, we're doing ourselves a disservice. We're doing the church a disservice. We're doing our community a disservice. We're doing our family a disservice. Of course, we need that. So I just want to share a bit out of the life of Moses around that. I just wrote here as an introduction, we often feel like God cannot use us because we're not in the right place, not ready. We don't have the right resources. We don't have the right ability. But just remember the little boy's lunch. The 2 fish and the 5 loaves. Remember that? And remember what happened? The key was he gave it to Jesus. Right? That was the key. I mean, if he tried to feed that whole crowd of 5,000 men, I mean, we don't even know how many women and children extra, with five little pieces of bread and two fish, I mean, most of the people wouldn't have even gotten a scrap. But if he took that which was in his hand, which was not enough, because he took it and he gave it to Jesus, it ended up being enough. And so often, that's such a beautiful picture to me of our calling. We take our not enough and we give it to the one who can make it enough through the miracle of multiplication, through just the supernatural miracle of. And it's amazing that he actually takes what we have. I mean, Jesus can create fish out of nothing. He did that in creation when he created the world. He said, let there be fish, and there were. Okay? He could have turned the stones into bread in the desert when the devil tempted him. He could have done that. He's God. He can do anything. But he chose to use those two little fish and those loaves of bread. And God chooses to use our contribution. He wants to partner with us. Because we're his children. And he wants us to participate. He wants us to experience the delight and the joy. So I just want to give you a little saying that I heard from a guy called Jeff Henderson. He said, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. If you start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can to obey God, because God is with you, even though where you start is not the right place. Moses said, I'm not eloquent, I can't speak. But read Deuteronomy and read how eloquent that is. In the New Testament, it says he was mighty in word and deed. So God obviously made him able. Okay? Start where you are. Use what you have. Moses said, I don't have enough. I only have a staff in my hand. Guess what? That staff was enough. Okay? And do what you can. Because God, if God's grace is upon you, if God's Holy Spirit is leading you, then even though what you can do in the natural is not enough, there's supernatural grace and empowerment to back that up and to take what you do and transform it into something spectacular. So that even today, Jews consider Moses to be the greatest prophet who ever lived. And it was the stammering guy who felt he couldn't do it. But look at what God did through him. So I remember mornings, 7 o'clock, Rochelle and I were both in the worship team. We had our own little church building, so we didn't have to set up every Sunday morning like we have to do here, you know, all the sound equipment and stuff. So we could start a bit later. We started at 7. Was it 7 o'clock, Rochelle? 7 o'clock. We started at 7 o'clock, and we pushed Kirsten. She was just a few weeks old. We pushed her in this orange and black, Greco. You know, pram into the, it was a nice pram, into the church building. And I mean, she was just literally a few weeks old, and she would sit there Sunday mornings from 7 o'clock, and we would practice worship, and she'd just sit and listen to us worshiping and practicing the worship. And then the service started, and of course, you know, pastor's kid, she gets handed around from one person to the other, and Rochelle and I are running around doing ministry, but the congregation's loving on her and just enjoying, you know, taking care of her. And she had such a nice big family, you know, to take care of her. And we might not know exactly why, but she needed that. I don't know what Kirsten's calling is, but I know she needed that to fulfill her calling. She needed to see us doing that, to be prepared for her calling. She needed to experience the congregation in that way to fulfill her calling one day. And maybe one day in heaven we'll understand. But I know she needed that. So let's look at Moses. Moses was born to a mother and father who were Levites in a terrible time of Israel's history where children were being killed by the Pharaoh, thrown into the Nile, to the crocodiles. Because very similar to what we're experiencing here in South Africa at the moment, the Egyptians felt threatened by the Hebrews. They were foreigners in a foreign land, and they were prospering. They were doing well for themselves. They were growing in numbers, and they were becoming a threat to the Egyptians. And so what did the Pharaohs decide? Same thing many South Africans are deciding. Let's eliminate them. But I mean, he's decided, let's start with the kids. All the kids, as soon as they're born, they must be taken, killed, thrown into the river, whatever. And Moses' mother, you know, she saw he was a beautiful child, and she just didn't want to give him up. And so she hid him for 3 months, somehow managed to keep it quiet. I'm sure the soldiers were going around trying to listen for kids crying. But somehow, you know, they managed to hide him for 3 months. And when they couldn't hide him anymore, she made a basket of papyrus and covered it with pitch and stuff to make it waterproof, put the baby inside and put him in the river. And, you know, if you look carefully, you'll see that there's a nice sort of throwback to Noah's Ark, you know, in that little basket. And just the salvation that it represents. But he floated down the river, and obviously God's hand was with him. And he ended up in the pool where the Egyptian princess, the daughter of Pharaoh, was bathing. And as she was bathing, and Miriam, his sister, ran, you know, at a distance, you know, following to see what would happen with this. And as the Egyptian princess saw this basket, she sent one of her maidservants and said, you know, go and check that out. And when the maidservant opened the basket, here's this little Hebrew boy crying, and brought him to the princess, and she had compassion and said, you know, I'm going to keep him and raise him. And Miriam jumps out from behind the reeds, and obviously, I mean, the princess hadn't had a baby recently, so she wasn't lactating, so she couldn't breastfeed. So Miriam, quick thinking, said, do you need a wet nurse? Do you need someone who can breastfeed this baby for you? I'll go and get a Hebrew slave to come and breastfeed this baby for you. And so she went to call her mother, and Moses' own mother ended up, you know, breastfeeding him and raising him for the first couple of months until he was ready to go to the palace. And then he ended up in the palace for about 40 years. And obviously he had a sense that God, and I don't know whether his mother and his sister had spoken to him about it when he was still small and sort of told him, listen, you're a Hebrew and God has a special plan for your life to rescue his people. But he had a sense of this because one day he was walking in Egypt and he saw an Egyptian abusing a Hebrew slave. And it says he looked to the left and the right and to check whether no one was watching. And he went and he killed the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. Obviously, it was in an attempt to save this Hebrew slave. So already beforehand, he had a sense of his calling. Obviously, he started, like so many people in the Bible, by completing that calling in completely the wrong way. Okay, and you'll see this is actually interesting. It's a pattern in biblical history. How guys start with a sense of their calling, but then at the wrong time. I mean, think of Abraham with his slave woman Hagar, and Ishmael is born. The right idea. He needed a son. That was part of his calling, you know, to have a descendant as many as the stars of the sky and as the sand of the sea. But he did it in the wrong way. He was trying to fulfill his calling in his own strength. And Moses was doing the same thing, trying to fulfill his calling in his own strength by murdering someone. Next day, he sees two Hebrews fighting and he says to the one in the wrong, why are you abusing your brother? And the guy turns around and he says, what are you going to do? Who made you judge and leader over us? Are you going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian yesterday? And Moses is like, oh my goodness, someone saw me. It must have become known what I've done. And he was very afraid. And when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill him and Moses had to run. So that was when he was about 40 years old. He runs into the desert, eventually ends up with meeting Zipporah and her six sisters at the well, helps them to feed the camels and stuff, ends up marrying Zipporah and being a shepherd for his father Jethro in the desert. And one day, he's walking, following the sheep, and he gets to Mount Sinai and he sees this bush that's on fire at Mount Sinai. And as he approaches, God starts to speak to him out of the bush. And God says to him, I've heard the cries of my people Israel. I am Yahweh. I am who I am. I'm the great I am. And I'm sending you back to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And let's just pick it up here in Exodus chapter 4, which is part of this burning bush account. It says, then Moses answered, and I want you to listen first to Moses' excuses. And I want you to think, what is your excuse? Because God is calling Moses here to do his will, to be part of his plan of salvation. And Moses is full of excuses. Okay? Moses answered, but behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, even though in the previous chapter God had said they will listen. For they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. So the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. And he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, a snake, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, put your out your hand and catch it by the tail. So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That, continues the Lord, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. And then God gives him two other miracles as well. And then in verse 10, it goes on. But Moses said to the Lord, here's the second excuse. So the first excuse was, they won't believe me. The second excuse, oh my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. Then the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth to teach you what you shall speak. But he said, oh my Lord, please send someone else. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he goes on and he says, okay, fine. You know, Aaron's going to come. Your brother Aaron's going to come. He's going to meet you. He's going to be glad to see you. And he can do the speak. You know, you can tell him what to say and he can speak. But the first thing I want you to notice is just like us so oftentimes. I mean, we think of Moses as this massive hero in the faith. And he was. But in reality, he was a very ordinary guy. Right? He was very ordinary. He had his insecurities. He had his problems. He wasn't this immensely capable guy in the natural. You know, he probably didn't speak that well, you know, apart from the anointing of God upon him. And his problem was that he was looking at himself. He was looking at his own ability or his own inabilities. Instead of listening to what God was saying, I am with you. I will be with your mouth. I'm with you. And so often we use those same excuses. I'm just not able to do it. We hear God calling us to do something for Him. We experience God drawing us, tugging at our hearts, placing a burden on our hearts for something or someone. And we know we just feel we have to do something, but then we think, surely not me, Lord. I'm not ready. It's not convenient. I don't have the resources. And we come up with all our excuses, just like Moses did. And you know, the strange thing is we don't realize that everything, I mean, we say, you know, God, I don't have the training for that. Moses had the perfect training for what God has called him to do. He didn't realize that, but he had a perfect training. The first 40 years, you know, in the palace of Pharaoh, so he could speak Egyptian fluently. He understood the culture. He was comfortable in those circles. He'd grown up as a prince of Egypt in the palace. He wasn't intimidated by that. He was the only Hebrew probably who wasn't intimidated by that and who knew his way around the palace. Who could actually go to Pharaoh and say to him, let my people go. And the second 40 years, being a shepherd in the desert, shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law Jethro, that's exactly what God called him to do after God had liberated Israel from Egypt. Shepherd his people Israel. So both those phases of his life were actually perfect preparation for what God has called him to do. And so often our lives are perfect preparation for what God has called us to do, and we don't realize it. And we say, I'm not ready. And God says, you're not seeing things clearly. Am I not sovereign? Will I not lead you in the right direction? If I'm going to call you to do something, will I not prepare you for it? And so often we look at what has happened to us and we don't recognize it as preparation. So often we look at what is happening to us and we don't recognize it as preparation. Do you realize that right now God is preparing you? So what's happening to you right now, on the one hand, is part of your calling, but it's also preparation for your calling. And that's why you have to be faithful now so that you can be ready for what God has called you for then. And not so you can be ready, but so your family can be ready, so your church can be ready for what God has called you to then. So just the question again, what is your excuse? We heard Moses' excuse. What is your excuse? When you hear the voice of God, when you feel the unction of God, the burden that God lays on your heart, Is it, Lord, I don't have the time? Or Lord, I don't speak well before people. I took a friend of ours, Mijalay, to, she's a mother of three, I think, and she did the honors in theology through Shofar Institute, part-time, you know, as a mother of three, working at home, taking care of the kids and so on. Initially, she did it in an unaccredited format. But when the guys who do our accreditation SATs, South African Theological Seminary, when they came to the graduation and all the others graduated with SATs diplomas and she just got a certificate, you know, because she'd done sort of the unaccredited version, the vice principal said to me, you know, who is that lady? I explained to him, you know, she's this, you know, incredible lady who's really worked hard, you know, as a mother of three, you know, did the course and actually did pretty well in it. And he said, no, send a marked assignments to me. And they actually gave her an honors degree. She graduated yesterday. So I took her to the graduation and she wears like thick glasses and she said to me, you know, she's very shy. She's extremely shy. You can ask Rochelle, we're friends. She's like one of the shyest people I know. Very introverted, very soft spoken, but quite bright, you know, and God clearly has a teaching anointing on her. And she says to me, you know, nowadays what she does when she has to speak before people, because she's, you know, has thick glasses and she doesn't see that well, she takes off her glasses so that she can't see the people. And then she speaks with all kinds of boldness and confidence, you know. But the reality is, it's so easy for us to make excuses, but if God is with us, no excuse is a legitimate excuse, because God has the ability to overcome all our weaknesses, all our disadvantages, all our lack of preparation. But even in that, we must realize that what you're doing now, I mean, it might be a job in the financial sector. You might be working in a bank or in a law firm or as a teacher, or I mean, not only is that your calling, that is also the equipping that God has given you. He has made you a shepherd. He has made you a lawyer. He has made you a this or that or the other thing, because He knows what He has called you to do. What you are doing now is developing the skills, not only to fulfill your calling now, but to fulfill your calling in the future. So I want to encourage you with that. And then just a little saying I heard from Lou Giglio, and this is very simple, but very powerful, I believe. He says, do what you are called to do as if God has called you to do it. Do what you have been called to do as though God has called you to do it. Because the reality, God has called you to do it, if you are called to do it. So what is your excuse? And then, you know, in response to Moses' excuses, God says to him, at one stage, in, I think it's in verse 2, He says to him, what is that in your hand? And he looks at it and, oh, it's a staff, a shepherd's staff. You know, just a normal shepherd's staff. And you know what? God takes something as ordinary. I mean, would you have thought, you know, if you had to lead a whole nation of slaves, deliver them first, liberate them from the superpower of the day, which was Egypt, and then lead this motley crew of slaves through the desert, through a sea and then through the desert to another country to conquer that. Would you have thought, oh, if only I had a staff, then I would feel better about myself. Then I would rate my chances. If only I had a staff, you know, that would have really helped. No one would think that. I mean, a staff is the most ridiculous thing. The most ordinary, just a shepherd's staff. I mean, come on. That's not going to do the trick. But God says, what's in your hand? Oh, a shepherd's staff. That'll do. I will make that do. Throw it on the ground, turns into a snake. Moses uses that staff to stretch it out across the Nile, and the water of the Nile turns to blood. Later on, he stretches it out over the Red Sea, and the Red Sea parts, and the Israelites can go through as on dry land. Later on, he uses that same staff to strike a rock, and water flows from it. It's just a staff. But guess what? When God gets hold of it, it's not a staff. And I believe that by using something as insignificant as a staff, God was trying to show Moses that He could use someone as insignificant as him. And he can use someone as insignificant as me, or as insignificant as you, because he's God. Ultimately, it doesn't depend on who I am or what I have in my hand. It depends on the fact that God is with me. So, you know, I just want to, once again, bring it back to your job situation. Moses was a shepherd. The staff, the shepherd's staff, was the tools of his trade. What are the tools of your trade that you have in your hand? What are the tools of your trade that you have in your hand? You might think, yeah, okay, you know, I have some skills and so on in this area. I have some tools. I have some knowledge, whatever. I have some competency. But, you know, I don't know. You know, it's good for making money or it's good for building a business, but I'm not so sure God can use it. Guess what? God can. If he can use Moses' shepherd staff, he can use whatever skill you have, whatever tool you have in your hand. It might be a pen that you write with or a computer that you write with. God can use it. It might be a voice that you sing with. God can use it. So I just want to encourage you. Exodus 4 verse 20. That's after. He says, what's in your hand? And it's a staff at the beginning of chapter 4. At the in verse 20, when it says, and he took his wife Zipporah and his child, and he put them on the donkey and he went to Egypt. It says, and Moses took the staff of God with him. Can you see the staff of Moses, which was in his hand, had become the staff of God? Because he consecrated it to the Lord. What do you need to consecrate to the Lord? What is in your hand that God wants to use? But guess what? As long as you're saying it's my staff, God can't use it. But as soon as you start saying it's the staff of God, then God can use it. As soon as you realize that God owns you and everything you have, and everything you are, all the skills you have, then in a sense you become the staff of God that God can use to do his will. In Sydney, in the 1930s, this word, eternity, started appearing all across the streets of Sydney. And someone wrote it in yellow chalk on the streets, on the pavements, in the doorways, you know, in the public spaces, you know, at the train stations, all that kind of stuff. And people started to notice this word eternity in exactly that writing, that sort of copper plate style of writing, you know, flowing copper plate style of writing, appearing all over the city of Sydney. And they'd walk around and then, you know, wake up in the morning, walk out the door, and there's eternity written on the pavement. And obviously people started wondering, I mean, what is this, you know? And they started thinking about it. And that word eternity obviously confronted them with their own mortality. I'm human. I'm going to die. I'm going into eternity one day. And they started thinking about that. But it was this big mystery. I mean, where does this word come from? And every morning there would be new occurrences, just eternity written on all kinds of places, in public places where people could see it, you know, and people would notice this and they start asking questions about this. And this went on for years, for many years. And every now and again, someone would come up and sort of claim, you know, it was me, I did it. And then the newspapers would run a story about this. And then it would come out, no, this wasn't the guy, you know, it wasn't the right guy. And this mystery would continue. And it continued for almost 25 years where every morning, you know, new occurrences of, you know, this was from the early 30s, I think 1932. New occurrences of the word eternity would appear on the streets of Sydney, and people just didn't know who it was. People wondering about this, and it was this big mystery, and it was really making people think about eternity, about their mortality, about the fact that they're going to die one day, and are they ready for eternity? Just that one word. Just that one word. And in 1956, a pastor in, I think it was Barton Street Baptist Church, I think he went to an early morning prayer meeting or something, and he stumbled upon one of his congregation members, a man called Arthur Stace, writing this word eternity in those letters in yellow chalk on the pavement. And the mystery was solved after 25 years. And from that day onwards, or you know, as things go on, Arthur Stace became known as Mr. Eternity. And he continued to write this word, eternity, sometimes up to 50 times a day. In the early morning hours, you know, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, when, you know, only the drunks and the prostitutes, you know, were still awake, you know, on the streets of Sydney, and people would see this. But obviously, he became a bit of a celebrity, you know, as time went on. Eventually, he booked himself in 1965 into a... before I get there, let me just start with his story from the beginning. He was born in 1885. He was born to a very poor family, a really poor family, Arthur Stace. So he was born into poverty. When he was 12 years old, things became so bad that he became a ward of the state. He was functionally illiterate. He couldn't really write. He said at 12 he became a ward of the state, and he at 14 he got his first job, and he says his very first paycheck that he received, he went to a hotel and he spent it all on booze. And got drunk. That's what he knew from his family. Both his sisters became prostitutes, or were prostitutes at that stage already, and his two brothers drank themselves to death eventually. He was a loser, a no-hoper, you know. He actually drifted around town. He didn't really have a place to stay, so he'd sort of drift around town. It was like eventually, because of the drunkenness and so on, he couldn't keep jobs, so he'd lose job after job after job, and eventually he turned to crime. He started stealing things. Then in 1916, he enlisted in the army, the Australian army, and he joined the First World War. Went to Europe. He served a bit in somewhere in Europe, I think Belgium and in England. And in 1919, he came back, and he was discharged because of injury he'd gotten, and he wasn't medically fit to serve anymore. And after he came back, he fell back into his alcoholic ways. He started drinking again, became a total alcoholic, and just he lived on the streets. And that continued for a couple of years. And then in 1932, I'll just read that to you. It says, Arthur Stace was a loser, a no-hoper, an alcoholic and complete illiterate. He lived in the streets of Sydney, regarded by many that saw him as a lost cause. And one Sunday night in 1932, he entered St. Barnabas Anglican Church in Broadway, Sydney, and he heard Reverend T.C. Hammond preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Arthur was convicted by the Spirit of God. He left the church, crossed the road, and sat under a tree in Victoria Park, where he committed his life to Jesus Christ. And then later that year, on the 14th of November, 1932, it was a sermon preached by Reverend John Ridley, and there's a little picture of him in his later years up there, that turns Stace into Mr. Eternity. Ridley, goes the newspaper, was a lively Baptist evangelist and was giving a sermon on eternity at the Barton Street Tabernacle. Eternity, what a remarkable, uplifting, glorious word, he cried to the congregation, because there is only one eternity. Oh, that I could shout and sound eternity all over the streets of Sydney. You have to meet eternity. Where will you spend eternity? So that was the sermon. And it says, as Stace tells it on the next slide, he walked out of the church with the words ringing in his brain. He was so impacted by the sermon and just those words, eternity. And what Ridley had said, you know, oh, that I could emblazon, you know, the streets of Sydney with this word eternity. He was seized to write the word. Well, actually, what he says, what happened was he felt in his pocket, and there was a piece of yellow chalk in his pocket. And he said he bent down and he just had to write that word, you know, on the pavement right there where he was. And he says, I had a piece of chalk in my pocket and I bent down and right there I wrote it. Stace admitted that he could hardly even write his own name legibly, but was amazed what came from the piece of chalk. In a hand worthy of a professional calligrapher, the word that changed his life, the word eternity. I mean, here's a guy who, what's in your hand? A piece of chalk. Oh, but Lord, I can't even write. But he didn't even make excuses. Lord, I can't write. He couldn't write. Could hardly even write his own name. He just bent down and he just, what was inside had to come out. And he was a very introverted, shy guy. So he couldn't really speak in front of people, and God obviously knew that. But what was inside had to come out, and he just wrote it, and somehow supernaturally God got him to write that word eternity. So every night during the early morning hours when everyone else was asleep, Stace would write eternity up to 50 times on the pavement, the streets, the doorways, and other visible public spaces in Sydney. Every night. And like I said, for the first 25 years, no one even saw him. No one knew who he was doing this. It was only discovered by his pastor, like I said, in 1956. And between 1932 and 1965, when he booked himself into a home, he wrote the word eternity more than 500,000 times on the streets of Sydney. On his gravestone, he's identified as Arthur Malcolm, Mr. Eternity, Stace. And they honored him by taking that word eternity and putting it in permanent letters. In permanent letters near the town hall in Sydney. It's still there today. So it's written on his grave, the word eternity, and on at the town hall. And the Australian newspaper wrote on November 3, 1990, it is Arthur Stace, Arthur Malcolm Stace, who wins our award for the one who overcame more obstacles to achieve fame, born in poverty, a ward of the state, a drunkard and petty thief, served in World War I, who fell into drunken dereliction thereafter. In 1932, he was, this is what the newspaper says, as one would now say, born again and became an urban missionary. Thus began the quiet meanderings of a man with the golden chalk and his enigmatic message to all of us. Eternity. Just a one-word sermon. Night after night after night, he wrote it on the streets of... So it says, at his burial at Sydney Botany in July 1967, the word eternity appeared at the foot of his grave as he scrawled it, you know, in that same copper plate flowing letters. And the headstone identified Arthur Malcolm Stace as Mr. Eternity. Sydney journalists said that he was the first and greatest graffiti artist. No other artist did it with one word 500,000 times like he did. And he just did it with a piece of chalk. In 1994, an art movie was made of his life. And in order to promote this art movie, you know, guys went out with pieces of chalk, you know, for a couple of weeks during the night, and they started writing the word eternity on the streets of Sydney again, just to promote the movie. The movie was a big success, and it won awards in more than a dozen countries. And the story of Arthur Stace, after his death, many years after his death, was seen by thousands of people when they watched this movie. It just started escalating. Now, this is quite long after his death. Now, the word eternity started to appear on buildings. Now, here at the bottom left, you can see they started making jewelry, like fancy, really fancy jewelry in this, with this word eternity in exactly the same form that Arthur Stace wrote it. They put it on flags. You got cups and t-shirts with the word eternity on it. And all that climaxed on the 1st of January 2000. When Sydney was the first major city to broadcast the New Year celebrations. And as the smoke of the firework display started fading away, all of a sudden, that word eternity appeared in letters 100 meters tall on Sydney Harbour Bridge in exactly the same letters that Arthur Stace wrote it so many decades ago. And in that moment, decades after his death, Arthur Stace reached hundreds of millions of people with his little one-word sermon, eternity. What is in your hand? What is in your heart? That same word that burned in his heart was now burning on Sydney Harbour Bridge for the whole world to see. Same word appeared again in 2000 with the Sydney Olympics, the opening ceremony of the Sydney Olympics, also watched by hundreds of millions of people. Same word eternity appeared again. And Arthur Stace, all of that happened by this little man, because of this little man, this introverted guy. Couldn't even write properly. He just had a piece of chalk. What's in your hand? Moses had a staff in his hand. Arthur Stace had a piece of chalk in his hand. What's in your hand? Do you really think that what's in your hand is so insignificant that God cannot use it? If you can use Arthur Stace's piece of chalk, surely you can use what we have in our hands as well. So my first question is, what is your excuse? My second question is, what is in your hand? And my third question is, what is your message? What is your message? That message of eternity so gripped Arthur Stace's heart that he couldn't let go of it. That was his message. Moses' message was just as simple. Let my people go. Go and read Exodus 5 verse 1, 7 verse 16, 8 verse 1, 9 verse 1, 10 verse 3, and a few times in between. That was his message. He just said, Pharaoh, let my people go. And your audience might be a hostile audience like Moses' was, or it might be an indifferent audience like Arthur Stace's was. It doesn't matter who your audience was. If God has put a message in your heart, don't keep it inside. In fact, if God has put a message in your heart, you'll say like Jeremiah, it's like fire in my bones. The word of the Lord is like fire in my bones. It's burning me. I can't keep it inside. It has to come out, just like Arthur Stace said. What is the message that's burning like fire in your bones? What is the eternity in your heart? Asked if he ever thought of changing his one-word sermon, Stace replied, no, it's always been the same. I think eternity gets across the message. It helps people stop and think. That was his message. He had one word, eternity. He didn't even, you know, initially, later on he started preaching it, but initially he didn't even preach it. He didn't even preach. He was too shy. He was too introverted. He just wrote it in waterproof chalk, you know, on the pavement of the city. And he's mentioned as a good example of someone who knows how to descend into greatness, just like Jesus did. So Ecclesiastes 11, 3 verse 11 says, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. God has put eternity in our hearts. And I think that's why Arthur Stace's little one-word sermon resonated with people so much. Because the eternity he wrote connected with eternity that God had already put in people's hearts. And drew them, made them stop and think, made them confront their own mortality. So, as Stace often said later on in street meetings he addressed, In his last years, the great question is not what you make of eternity, but what eternity will make of you. What eternity will make of you. He was a very simple man, uneducated, down and out, started off as a poor, drunk vagabond, wandering the streets of Sydney. He had a piece of chalk in his hand, and he had the word eternity burning in his heart. Start where you are, use what you have, do what you can, and you'll be amazed at what God can do with that. You'll be amazed at what God can do with that. So, I just want to challenge all of us, in the light of who God is, and the fact that God is with us, can any excuse we have stand? You know, what is your excuse? Bring your excuse to God and find out. Our fears are unfounded. Our worries, our doubts are unfounded. God is greater than all of them. Then what is in your hand? What is in your hand might look insignificant to you. It might look like it's not going to do the task. But Moses' staff became the staff of God and he did the job. Arthur Stace's little piece of yellow chalk. And every night, you know, he rewrote that word eternity until his little piece of chalk was done. And then he'll just buy a new piece of chalk. It looks so insignificant, but look at the impact it has. Look at how many hundreds of millions of people have been confronted with eternity because of his little one-word message. And then finally, what is your message? What is your message? Each of us has a message burning inside of us like fire in our bones. You might not know what it is yet, but then part of your calling is to find out. Part of your calling is to find out. I'm not sure I can sort of articulate my message in sort of a few words or a sentence, but I think I know that the Word and the Spirit will be right at the heart of it. the Word of God and the Spirit of God, and the two of those coming together. I know that's a big part of my message. What is your message? And then start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can, and see what God does through that.